Robert Jennings is a prisoner in Texas. If the state has its way, he'll be dead within the hour. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world, where prison staff is preparing to put Jennings to death by injecting him with a deliberate drug overdose. During the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will broadcast live coverage of the killing in Texas, the state responsible for half of all executions in the U.S. Execution Watch host Marlo Blue, with criminal defense attorneys Larry Douglas, Mike Gillespie, Jack Lee, and Paige Yannick. Huntsville reporter outside the death house, Linda Huhan, and special guest Gloria Rubeck. The Execution Watch for Robert Jennings begins.
Good evening, and welcome to the Wednesday, January the 30th edition of Execution Watch. Whether you're listening live on one of our FM channels, 90.1 FM or 89.7 in Huntsville, or simulcast and archived at kpft.org, thank you for joining us. I'm your host, Marlo Blue. If you are tuning in for Arab Voices with your host, Saeed, usually heard here every Wednesday from 6 to 7 p.m., please check back next week when it resumes its regularly scheduled time slot. We welcome your opinions on social media and beyond. To learn more about the death penalty and executions in the state of Texas, join us on Facebook at Execution Watch or online at executionwatch.org. Join our mailing list for all of the latest updates. Tonight we stand in vigil as the state of Texas plans to execute Robert Jennings for the 1988 shooting of a Houston police vice officer at an adult bookstore. Jennings was on parole at the time of the shooting. Joining us in the studio to put this case in perspective is our panel of experts, Larry B. Douglas, Mike Gillespie, Jack Lee, and Paige Yannick. Welcome to everyone. This program is the first and only live electronic vigil where we provide first-hand reports of the Texas death machine in action. We appreciate those of you joining us internationally on the World Wide Web. And we join those of you who stand in vigil on the streets of the Texas city and in front of the death house in Huntsville. Our reporter, Linda Huhan, joins us now live by phone from outside the death house in Huntsville. Linda, describe the scene for us, please.
It's very somber out here at this moment. Everyone here is quiet. There's about 12 of us. Right now, the ministers and the media are crossing the going into the death house. The family will be crossing over in just a few minutes. It looks like everything's going through. There's no one is stopping it at this moment.
Now, you said that there are 12 people out there with you standing witness, and it's the family has gone ahead and agreed they've already crossed over. Is that correct?
They're fixing to.
Because, of course, of the prominence of this case, because it involves a Houston police officer, tell me, has the atmosphere, is it different?
It is different. There are Houston police officers here. There are a lot of police officers compared to, you know, what normally there are. It's not as wild as it was when the Texas 7 guy was executed, though. It's a lot quieter. It's more respectful.
Are they doing the traditional revving of motorcycles?
There was a couple of motorcycles that went by, but it wasn't like it was with the Texas 7.
And Linda, we hear that there isn't any supposed word of a stay, but is there still hope?
I don't think so, not according to what we've been told. Robert did not want to have a stay because he said he did not want to live. The only other option he had was to live the rest of his life in prison. And he said he was tired. That's what he said today I'm tired. I don't want to live the rest of my life in prison, and that's my only option.
He has been there a long time.
Yes, and he told his attorneys this morning that I don't want you to fight for me anymore.
Well, Linda, I hope that you will please let us know when you receive word. We'll be standing by for your next report.
I sure will. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We will be going to Jack Lee for some insight. He's going to start us off with a little bit of the commentary of what is happening and how this case developed. But first, let's go to Gloria Rubick, who is here to give us a very important update and to tell us of something else that has happened. Gloria, are you online? All right, we'll wait until we get her back onto there. Jack, let's start with you. Please tell us about this case. What's happened?
All right. So first I'm going to go over the facts of what happened. Then we'll open up to the other attorneys, and there are two main issues that we're going to hit on. But so this is a case. Robert Jennings, in July 19, 1988, had walked into an adult bookstore. And as he walked in, he noticed there was a police officer by the name of Elston Howard, who was in the process of issuing citations to the clerk at the adult bookstore to arrest him. He was wearing an HPD jacket, Jennings denies knowing that he was a HPD officer. But at any rate, Jennings walked in and very quickly rushed at Howard, the police officer, and shot him twice in the back. And at that point, Howard tried to leave the premises, rushed back towards the premises, towards the front door, and then fell. And Jennings came up and put two more rounds into his head. Three of the four shots were determined to be fatal. Jennings denied at trial that he knew Howard was a police officer.
Well, was he wearing a uniform?
Yes, he was. He was wearing a uniform, and the jacket that Howard was wearing had Houston Police Department, and had it on the front, had it on the back, and there were three witnesses to this shooting. The three witnesses to the shooting said that all of this took place within about 2-3 seconds.
All right. Let's put a little pin in there and for a moment and go to Gloria Rubick. Gloria?
Hi, Marla.
Hi. Where are you tonight?
I am standing about 50 yards from the entrance to the death house and just watched Robert's friends and spiritual advisors walk in.
And before we actually talk about Robert, there are two things that I would really like to ask you about. Number one, you and I believe some of your friends from your organization, and you are such an activist, did something to put a little humanity to one of the death row inmates who was really not given any humanity. Can you tell us about that?
Are you talking about Alvin Brazil?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, he called me. I think his execution took place on December 11th. He called me that afternoon. We weren't friends. We had exchanged maybe one letter or two. But, we talked for a while, and then he asked me if Deloitte Parker, who's the director of the SHAPE Center, where the abolition movement is based, if Deloitte had gotten his letter. And I said, well, you know what, I have no idea if he got it or not. He said, well, I'd like to call him. So I gave him the number for the desk at SHAPE Center, and he talked with Phyllis, the volunteer who answered the phone for a while, and then Deloitte got on, and they put him on speakerphone, and then about four or five different people got to speak with him for, I want to say, an hour or more.
That's pretty unusual, too, isn't it?
It very. because I walked, I actually walked into SHAPE to pick up one woman who was going to come with me to protest.
Right.
She was standing there at the desk with everybody who was talking to Alvin. But he, I don't know his situation. I know that he asked Deloitte to come pick up his property, so Deloitte gave us three or four of these red onion sacks that they put their property in. And at our last meeting, we put four big tables together and we went through the property, and some people, you know, we just kind of divided it up. Somebody wanted the chips and somebody else wanted the pickles, and I took the sardines and Louisiana hot sauce. This was all food he bought at the commissary. And I'm thinking that he didn't have a lot of friends. He must have been a loner, because I believe that usually the guys give their stuff away before they're going to be executed.
What would you say to anyone listening at this moment on death row? What would your advice be about their personal effects?
Well, hopefully most people have friends or family that they can leave their effects to. If not, you know, we'd be happy to come send somebody up here to pick them up. I think that Alvin just wasn't a real social person, so he had a lot of stuff that he didn't give away. The only thing we threw away was this thing of yellow stuff that was supposed to be some kind of cheese spread, but once we read the ingredient list, we decided it wasn't fit for human consumption, and we tossed it.
And before we move on, I do want to ask you a little bit about Alfred Brown. Can you give us an update on what's going to happen with him?
Yes, it finally looks like he's going to be compensated for 12 years of wrongful imprisonment on death row. Kim Ogg, I think 3 years ago or more, said she was going to look into it. And he was actually worried because the deadline for asking for compensation is 3 years. But he found out it was 3 years once they say you're innocent. So they didn't say that right away. And Ogg, the Houston DA, appointed a man, I think his name was Rayleigh, to investigate. And he finally released his report. And I really have to say that the Houston Police Department spokespeople are such idiots to say that he scammed his way off death row. Well, that's really hard to do, and he didn't. He was innocent, and it was a cop that had all of a sudden found in a box in his garage the phone records that show that he was on a landline phone at his girlfriend's house talking to her at work when the crime took place, so he couldn't possibly have been there. Alfred got the heck out of Texas and has been living in Louisiana, raising horses, and has a lot of family there, and is doing well. He's a member of Witness to Innocence, which is... the only way you can be a member is if you got exonerated off death row. And now it looks like he's going to finally get compensated.
It's always good to hear that somebody's reintegrating back into society and doing well. We're always happy to hear that.
Yeah. Every photo I see of him has just a big, beautiful smile on it.
And your organization still has monthly meetings that people can find information on the website. Is that correct?
On our Facebook page, and our page is The Texas Death Penalty Abolition Movement. And February 5th, next Tuesday, we're having, instead of a meeting, we're going to have a brief business meeting before 7, and then we're having a Black History Month forum, because we realized a lot of younger people don't know some of the history that has happened with death row in Texas. So Clarence Brandley's brother and Deloitte Parker, who were the leaders of the Coalition to Free Clarence Brandley, will be speaking. Unfortunately, Clarence died in September.
He just recently passed.
Yeah.
What a nice man.
But he got out of here. Oh, my gosh. There's the idiots.
They're revving, aren't they?
Yeah. Walk a little farther away.
For those who don't know, whenever there is a killing or whenever there's an execution of someone who is purposely or has been accused of killing a police officer, there is what they call the blue line, where they rev their motorcycles. They make as much noise as possible.
And they wait until about this time when the person is asked to give their last words.
Yes, as a silence.
Families have said, I think it was Moses Garcia that was executed in December. He had to stop talking because the noise was so loud. And they're on the side of the prison where the death takes place.
And these walls, although we call them the wall, they're not as thick as you would imagine.
Anyway, and then Chaka Sankofa's mother, Elnora Graham, and his attorney, Dick Burr, will be speaking about his case.
And this will happen at your February meeting that's coming up.
Excellent. Yeah. And then Kofi Taharka is going to be talking about the hostage that a couple of the death row prisoners took in 2000 when they were sent to this supermax prison where they're in solitary confinement. And he and two other people were called in to mediate between the prisoners and the prison staff. And then we're going to talk about Frances Newton. The car's open.
Gloria, thank you very much. I encourage people who would like to learn more about the death penalty. This is the way to do it, is to go to a meeting, find out people, check out on their website, check out on Facebook, so many different things that you can do.
Yeah, so it'll be next Tuesday at the Shape Center, 3815 Live Oak at 7 o'clock, and we welcome you to join us.
Thank you so much. We've been speaking with activist Gloria Rubick. And I'm now back onto the studio right here at 419 Lovett Boulevard, KPFT. If you are expecting Arab Voices right now with your host, Saeed, he will be back next Wednesday in his regular time slot. For the moment, you are listening to Execution Watch. The time is now 8:18. Let's go back to Jack Lee. Jack?
All right, so I wanted to give everyone a flavor of what Robert Jennings was like. He has a fairly extensive criminal background. before I get into that, at trial, he was arrested soon after he shot and killed Elson Howard. He was apprehended a few days later, where he gave a confession. So at trial, there really weren't a whole lot of at guilt innocent stage. There was not a whole lot of to argue about. So most of the arguments would have come down during the punishment phase, whether or not he should be assessed the death penalty. And Robert Jennings has a fairly extensive record. At sentencing, his record would have come out. He was arrested. He was on probation, juvenile probation, when he was 14. 2 years later, at 16, his probation was revoked, and he was sent to TYC. Now, he gets out of TYC.
And that specifically stands for
Texas Youth Council. Basically, it's a prison for juveniles. So, at 17, he was convicted of an aggravated robbery. At 17, that makes him an adult, and he was sentenced to 5 years. 2 years later, 3 years later, in 1978, when he was 20, He committed, on parole, he committed two aggravated robberies and a burglary of habitation. And for those two, he was sentenced to 30 years concurrently. 2 months after he got out of on parole in 1988 at the age of 30, he is when he committed this crime. It was subsequently found out that he had committed, in these 2 months, he had committed six aggravated robberies. He was targeting restaurants, nightclubs, adult bookstores, and adult cinemas. And all of this was done in a 3-month period. This was probably not somebody you'd want to invite over for dinner. During the punishment phase is when you start when you discuss mitigating evidence that the defense would bring up to demonstrate that, you know, this guy, he's not that bad, that there's not a he's not future danger to society, and he should get life in prison, as opposed to at the time there wasn't the option of life in prison, but that he should not be executed. And in the end, there are two main issues that came up during the appeal process. The first of which is the ineffective assistance of counsel, and that shows up in practically every death penalty case. That's where everyone throws the kitchen sink. And the second issue is the one, is what we call the penury cases. It's, cases regarding, mental health and and how we deal with folks who are convicted on capital crimes, who have mental health issues.
And that has come up in this particular case. Larry, you have something to say?
Yeah, just briefly. I just want to, Jack, I just want to just supplement the facts just a little bit.
Sure.
And that is that Jennings actually went into the store, the adult bookstore, to rob the store.
Oh, right.
That was his intention.
That's correct.
He admits this.
Correct.
He went there, and he did rob the store. Okay. So after killing the officer, he then proceeds to rob the store, and then he goes out to his getaway driver, who has been working with him in a series of robberies, and he tells the getaway driver, "I think I shot a security guard." The getaway driver says, "Well, he never has been, you know, too smart. But when I saw him, that he had killed somebody, that wasn't part of the deal. We're doing robberies. We're not doing killings." So he said, "Get out of my car." And Jennings wouldn't get out. So the getaway driver shoots him in the hand to make him get out of the car.
A little motivation.
And so when he gets out of the car, he's actually discovered, or he's actually captured when he goes to the hospital to get treatment for his gunshot wounds. And the driver then leaves town and goes up to the Dallas area, I believe.
Where goes home.
Goes his merry way.
Right. So I just wanted just a friendly supplement there, Jack.
Thank you.
Paige, you had something to say?
Well, it's just that Mr. Jennings had this enormous history of violence and criminality prior to committing this murder. And he went in to commit a robbery and ended up killing a cop who was wearing a police raid jacket with police prominently displayed upon the back and the sleeves. So it's not like Mr. Jennings was unaware that he was a cop. It's an HPD raid jacket. And then he goes ahead and shoots the cop 4 times and then robs the store. And Mr. Jennings had robbed that same store 2-3 weeks previous. So it was not like Mr. Jennings did not appreciate the consequence of his actions.
Well, of course, Robert Jennings, this was 1988. Are we talking about the same person?
Of course we are.
Yes.
Well, he certainly may have changed in that 29 plus year period. But we're not, if it's happened in 1988, we're talking not just a potentially matured person, but a different set of laws than under which capital murders are tried. Explain. Now as compared to 1988. Well, Jack mentioned Penry. Okay. And Penry pretty much set the tone of how capitals are to be tried as it relates to mitigating evidence at punishment.
And mental illness.
Particularly as it relates to mental illness. So after Penry, it was clear that if you've got a client who is accused of capital murder, you have to exhaust the efforts to find as much possible mitigating evidence as it relates to mental health issues, in order to be effective as counsel.
And did his counsel do that?
His counsel did looked at the case and looked at the facts that were in front of him. They came to the conclusion that there was no mental retardation. There was nothing about Jennings that suggested that there was a mental retardation. However, on the previous case, that said, on the previous case in 1978, when he was 20, he did go through a psychological evaluation, and that in that psychological evaluation, there was the suggestion that there was mild retardation, and the person doing the psychological evaluation said, you know, I'm not really sure. He may be hamming up his retardation faking the retardation in order to drag the case on longer.
How can you fake retardation? I mean, how can
you want
you
me
fake
to try
it
right now?
Preferably
I can.
Not actually, but I mean,
I mean, I can fake it
to a trained expert. I mean, isn't an expert exactly the type of person who should know the difference?
And the expert did know the difference and said that he was attempting to fake mental retardation.
Let's bring Mike Gillespie into this discussion a little bit, Mike.
What I don't understand is what the government was doing from the time the kid was 14 years old. If you're 14 years old and you're being put in juvenile facilities, isn't that where they're supposed to get you ready for society? He spent 14 until 17 under government control. And I don't know about his mentally retarded, but his IQ was 65. Yeah, IQ 65 from 14 years in life you spent locked up. Kid never had a chance.
If you gave me a IQ test and I wanted to score low, I could score really low for you if you'd wanted me to.
But maybe he really was 65.
Maybe.
The fact that, let's talk about IQ. I'm a professional armed robber. I did already one already that night. I now walk into a store to commit a robbery and I see a police officer. Wouldn't I just walk out the door, come back when he left? What kind of intelligence actually does a robbery with a policeman there?
Unless he's just incredibly aggressive and, you know, at 14 he was on probation. At 16 he got sent to TYC. At 20 he was, at 17 he was convicted. At 20 he was convicted. I mean, he's got a bit of a history. He has a bit of a history of violence.
Under government control. And we spend as taxpayers over $40,000 a year in order to support him. What has the government done to help him? And by the way, when he came to his final parole, don't you think they had a good workup? He's in prison. He's dealing with guards. He's dealing with people. This is the opportunity for the government to find out all about him. If he was that bad, why'd they release him for?
And why did they release him early?
Overcrowding.
Early. Overcrowded.
Overcrowded.
So whose fault is it?
Overcrowding and just ordinary parole in the 80s.
Yep.
And the next question I have is, let's do a little bit of blaming on the government.
I'm always down for that.
I know from my experience that Before the 80s, they would never allow anybody to wear the blues unless you were a police officer. Security guards had to wear browns so people knew they were security guards, not police officers. Then they all of a sudden wanted more presence in the street, so they let everybody wear blue. And now you can't tell a security guard from a police officer. There should be no reason why people would mistake a security guard from a police officer. Two different color uniforms.
But that is now, and we're back talking then. About the 80s.
That's what happened in the 80s.
He was wearing a jacket that said police, front and back. I mean, if you were to make the argument he didn't know how to read.
I don't know. I was going to say that, but I don't know. But what I'm saying is
he should
not
out
be
in
able
ninth grade.
To make a distinction between a policeman and a security guard. Mm-hmm. And let's talk about the...
Let's do talk about it, but right now it is 6:30 in the evening. You are listening to KPFT 90.1 FM here in Houston, 89.7 in Huntsville. You are listening to Execution Watch, the only online vigil, the only electronic vigil telling you that is brought to you every time that the state of Texas puts someone to death. Let's continue the conversation.
What did the government do to get him ready to get a job when he got out? All a guy could do was do stick-ups.
You know, the government...
Did they have a duty to see that you have some skills so you can go get a job and make a living? The fact he got out of prison and he's doing the same thing all over again, why was he released to be in a situation where the only way he can make money? Number one. Number two, he's doing drugs already. Doesn't he got a parole officer?
I've got a question.
Wasn't he
to ask
tested?
He was only out on parole for 2 months before he committed this capital murder.
Is that how long it takes
to
see a parole officer?
Robert Jennings could
2 months?
I have a question. Do we know if Robert Jennings could read?
No, we don't.
We don't know with certainty whether anyone can read, but we do know that he was a ninth grade dropout. So I would presuppose that he knew how to identify letters, and probably given his experience, he knew what police looked like, and he probably could read the word police.
I don't think that there's any real question as to whether Robert Jennings was probably not the smartest guy in the world. 65 IQ is probably correct in this case. The fact is he did kill a police officer, making it a capital. Now the issue is, does the state have to kill him? And so we have to look at how our laws work. Because in order to, for them to hand down a sentence of death, the jury, okay, who at the punishment phase has to find unanimously that there's not sufficient mitigating evidence to avoid the death penalty and grant life in prison. That has to be unanimous. And what Penry, which was tried, which was held, which was decided while this case was going on, what Penry holds is, one, it's not cruel and unusual to execute a person who has who's mentally deficient. But that the issue needs to be submitted to the jury, and the defense is required to provide, first of all, find out about, and then provide mitigating evidence. The only witness at punishment was the chaplain at the Harris County Jail.
Yeah.
Who testified that Jennings appears to have been improving while he was in custody awaiting trial.
Right.
There's a mountain of evidence suggesting how bad he was. The trial counsel determined that Jennings had a terrible upbringing. He was in a poverty-stricken family, not unusual. His mother claimed that he was the product of a sexual assault, a rape. Okay.
When she was like 16.
She gave birth to him at 17, never finished high school, blamed him and told him that he was to blame for her inability to complete her education. She never liked him, never took care of him, and she was also a single mother who regularly used drugs. So the lawyer decided, well, we'll get this evidence on by having Jennings come forward and testify, assuming the judge allows him to testify without bringing all of the other evidence in against him, the punishment evidence at guilt innocence. The judge says, I'm not going to do that. So the only way he could have put Jennings on is that his priors would have come in. Jennings' position is, my priors are going to come in anyway, so let's just go ahead and put me on. But the counsel elected not to put him on, which is probably a good idea.
Oh, yeah.
Could have put his mother on. Okay. The mother could have testified about all the terrible upbringing. And Jennings wanted the mother to testify. Counsel says, well, you know, mother's not a particularly sympathetic witness. Jennings says, fine, put her on. She's my mother. She's not sympathetic to me. That's why that could explain why I am the way I am today. Well, since the mother's not sympathetic, then I don't want to put her on. Okay. What about my sister? Interview the sister. My sister can testify of how terrible my mother was. Well, your sister's too young. What? Okay. So at that point, that decision seems not to be a particularly good decision, at least not to put the sister on, in terms of, because you've got to have some kind of mitigating evidence, because all we're looking for at punishment is one. Because if one juror says that we're not convinced beyond a reasonable doubt that the mitigation does not,
a future dangerousness and mitigation,
then you get life.
Right.
Well,
okay.
And
then
mitigation involves humanizing your client in front of the jury. And were the sister to have testified, that would have humanized him. Were the mother to have testified, that would have humanized him. And then the jury would more likely have found that there could have been some mitigating evidence.
And when you say the jury, we're just talking about one.
Yeah.
Just one member of the jury.
Well, one of the 12, yes.
But beyond that, if this were a post-Penry kind of case, it is likely that the lawyer would have, and the lawyer pretty much confessed deficiency for not investigating the evidence in the prior cases. I never even read the file. Okay, never looked at the prior case. The references to his mental health issues that may have been, and there was evidence of some sort of a head injury or something of that sort. So we might have there might have been some brain trauma that should have at least been investigated. Now, but when you look at that issue, applying the Strickland standard, saying that the lawyer's performance needs to be deficient, and but for the deficient performance, that really the outcome would likely have been different. That Jennings was harmed by that, by the deficiencies.
But okay. Strickland happened 25 years after
exactly.
This case.
Right. And so we're trying, we're looking at a 1988 case by 2019 standards.
Right.
You are listening to Execution Watch here on KPFT 90.1 FM, where we are having the electronic vigil for Robert Jennings. I believe we have our witness in front of the death house on the phone now. Let's go live to Huntsville with Linda Hujan. Linda.
Yes, hi, this is Linda. The witness has just crossed back across the line, and it's over. I have another thing I need to say. The police were not nice. During his witness's final statement, they started gunning their engines just as loud as they could. So we're not sure if he was able to hear it. We don't know. They were very rude. They were nice before he was executed, but as they were flowing the drugs into his system, they were very, very rude. I'm sorry I said they were nice in the beginning, because in the end they were not nice.
And the atmosphere now, how is it?
very sad.
Linda, I give comfort to the family if you can when you see them. Thank you for reporting for us. And, of course, if you don't mind, we're going to use you again if the state of Texas does have its next execution on February the 18th.
I'll be here.
Thank you. That'll be with Billy Cobble. Again, repeating what Linda Hujan just said. Thank you very much, Linda. The execution has been completed. Robert Jennings is dead. He has been put to death by the state of Texas for the murder of an undercover policeman here in
Houston.
He was
not undercover.
All right. But he's been... Excuse me?
He was
the vice, I'm sorry, yeah, the vice
not
officer.
He was the vice not undercover. Officer. He was there executing a warrant.
All right, for the vice officer that was there finishing up another job. And the time is now at 6:40. You are listening to Execution Watch. Let's go back to our always delightful lawyers.
Well, before we continue the discussion, I wanted to give everyone some perspective as to the mechanics of the execution. So once they inject him and once he's determined to be dead, murdered by the state of Texas, they take the body to they rush the body to a chapel next door, so that the family can touch the body while it's still warm one last time.
Yes, they do, and this is sometimes the very first time that any family members ever have an opportunity to even touch their loved ones, to be with their loved ones since the incarceration has begun. Always between walls, always between windows where you are not able to actually have that physical comfort of being with your loved ones. Is that correct, Jack?
That is correct.
And you have this from firsthand experience? Have you been to an execution?
I've never been executed.
Have you been to an execution?
I have not.
Very good. Let's continue on, please. So did race enter in on this in the slightest bit? We've just had a stay earlier this month.
There doesn't seem to be anything in the trial record that suggests that race played a part.
Mike?
I hate to be picking on our government, but I started by saying why are not security guards have different color uniforms. They don't because back in the late 70s, they decided they wanted more presence on the street. So everybody wore blue. The first thing they did. The second thing they did is they took the old policy of two policemen in a car and split them up so there's more presence on the street. What I question is this was the old days with two policemen there. Assuming he came in, took one shot. Was the first shot a fatal shot?
He didn't come in and take one shot. He came in and took two shots.
Well,
and then he took two more.
But with the second police officer in the room, he might not have gotten his second shot off.
Let me answer your question. So there are three. He was shot for. Elston Howard was shot four times. It was determined at the autopsy that the first two shots went to his back and shoulder, and both of them were fatal. Then when Jennings approached him after Elston Howard rushed to the front door and then collapsed, Jennings put two more rounds into his head. One of the two was fatal. So yes, the first shot would have been fatal.
And didn't he walk in with a gun in his hand?
Well, slow down. Yes, the first one would have been fatal.
Okay, but he walked in with a gun in his hand.
Correct.
The policeman has got his back, given the ticket to the store owner.
Ticket and arrest.
If another policeman is in the room, he might have seen the guy walking with a gun.
Then again, the police officer might not have.
I'm here to wonder what the government, we spent over $2 million keeping this guy locked up. We spent $680,000 out of this time. What is the purpose of putting a 14-year-old person in jail and leaving him there and not trying to do something with him?
He was on probation at 14.
But he was
revoked at 16 and then went to TYC. And then at 17, he was convicted where he did sentenced to 5 years. And he came out 2 years later, committed two more ag robs and a burghab, and then was sentenced to 30 years concurrent. So, you know, this was not a guy you wanted to invite over for dinner.
Either am I.
I'd invite you over for dinner. In fact, I have.
And I guess the real question is should he have been killed by the government? And under this set of circumstances where you've got a young man, he got in trouble real young, and his mother said, you are the product of a rape, treated him horribly, treated her children horribly. And if that evidence had been presented to a jury, would one of them have decided, maybe we can keep this man in prison for maybe a life sentence might have been good enough for one? Okay, now, you know, the cost of seeking the death penalty is much higher than just putting him in prison. Okay, and that's the concern I have. And so I'm when I look at our system, the concern I have is that, you know, Jennings was a pretty bad person, but And we've got lots of write-ups when he was in prison. He was not a model prisoner, and I would not want to be one of the guards serving in prison with him. But what would a jury have done? We're left with that question. What would a jury have done had they heard about the tragic upbringing that he had? Because that tragic upbringing and combined with possible evidence, I'm not saying that there was evidence because there was no investigation, possible evidence that there might have been some brain trauma, would that have resulted in the saving of his life? I mean, that's the way our system is structured.
Well,
and that's the question we still have.
It tried now, would there have been a different result? I think that becomes the real question that we can ask ourselves. I don't know whether or not, because we don't have enough evidence to show that there would have been a different result now. I know it would have been a different trial. I know that we would have had the possibility of life without parole as opposed to death. I mean, I know that many things would be different were it tried today, were it tried with a different set of punishment facts and a different kind of punishment investigation. But this was tried in 1989, prior to Penry. I mean,
Let me give some perspective regarding a segue in for Penry. You know, one of the cases that followed Penry was Atkins, and in Atkins, the Supreme Court said, you know, yeah, the guy was had an IQ of 59. He's still mentally, you know, he's still okay to execute. So, as far as his mental deficiencies that Jennings tested at 65, I don't think it really would have mattered.
But here's the other problem. He was really punished twice. He spent 30 years in jail, and then they executed him.
Well, he didn't quite spend 30 years in jail. He spent 10.
30 years.
He was sentenced 30 years.
He spent 30 years since this happened.
Oh, okay.
Since 1989, Jack.
Gotcha.
So he spent 30 years in prison, and then they kill him.
Well, he went ahead and had many habeas cases on his conviction, and each one of them required a delay and a time period.
You know, they're doing something in Philadelphia, which I think is interesting. They got a new DA in Philadelphia, and they have allow now that defense lawyers allowed to bring to the jury the cost of locking somebody in jail, the economic cost to the taxpayers. They don't just hear how many years, they hear what's it going to cost you to lock them up.
At punishment.
I think that's an interesting concept, to see what it's going to cost to lock a man in jail. I say if he would have got life in prison, it would have been cheaper, because he already spent 30 years. He was 61.
No question about that.
There is
no
doubt
arguments there.
That it would have been cheaper to keep him in prison for the rest of his natural life. But life without parole was not an option for the jury in 1989.
Which gets to the next interesting thing that Randy brought up in the appeal, and it's a tough one, retroactive punishment. You can't, if somebody has been arrested with marijuana and the case is on appeal and all of a sudden marijuana is legal, why is that person punished?
Just for our viewers, marijuana is still not legal in Texas.
I understand, but I'm talking theoretically as an example. What happens that if the law changes and what you go into prison for is not against the law anymore? Should it be retroactive? I don't know. I mean, if somebody should get the benefit that we get to be a more mature society on mental illness, on the things we're talking about him, we all agree it'll be different now.
I believe, Michael, I don't remember specifically what it's called, but the retroactivity is not against the Constitution.
For guilt or innocence.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as punishment and death penalty, we should be retroactive because
I believe it's unconstitutional. I believe there were some cases with Jefferson in the, I want to say, 18-teens.
We're now in the year 2017.
I understand, but
and
it's
I'm
still
saying to you,
unconstitutional.
Should we go back and right. take into effect the change in society and the change in norms now?
Let me try to make this more clear. It's unconstitutional.
We can change the Constitution.
And we can do that.
And there are 26 amendments to prove it.
On the point that Mike is making, though, okay, now, we're not talking about ex post facto or anything of that sort, but recall now when the Texas sodomy statute right. was declared unconstitutional, there were people in prison.
Yep.
Okay.
Including our former host, Ray Hill.
Okay, there were people in prison. There were people in prison at the time, and when that was declared unconstitutional, that let those guys go.
Right.
Similarly, if someone has been sentenced to death and we have such a major change in the law, does it make sense for us to look back at those cases and say, particularly, I don't know if you can to take advantage of the fact that we've delayed this thing 30 years and left this man in prison for 30 years, I think we've got a great system, but there are some flaws in the system. And when you're talking about something like putting a person to death, my feeling is we might want to take another look. And there's no law that allows it right now, such as, you know, declaring sodomy unconstitutional and then letting people go out of releasing people. I mean, clearly, the death penalty statute is not unconstitutional. The analogy doesn't work completely.
I agree.
But just as a thought, it's something that might need to be considered, especially as it relates to death.
Well, and the thing about retroactivity is the retroactivity generally applies to guilt innocence and not to punishment issues. And so if they change the law on whether or not you've committed an offense, then retroactivity may apply. But retroactivity almost never applies to punishment issues.
Oh, agreed, Paige. And then I was just saying that some thought needs to be given to, but only in death penalty cases, because death is something that's irreversible.
Yeah, well, it's different.
And that's also why they have governor's clemency. And this is something where a governor can say, the crime committed at the time was a crime. You can't change that. But because of society, this punishment, we can have mercy on punishment because now the world is different. We need to save people's lives, not keep executing people. And sometimes I think it's all about money. It's all about expenses. And I do not understand, first of all, what I think he was going to do when he got out. He had no trainings. He had no skills. Why do we spend $2 million just feeding him? Not even talking about legal fees. You think they could have done something with him to give him an opportunity to work when he got out? He went back the same thing. All he could do was rob people.
Well, that's all he knew how to do. Again, you are listening to Execution Watch. We are here for this electronic vigil at the after the execution of Robert Jennings. And I want to thank my panel that's here tonight, Mike Gillespie, Larry B. Douglas, Jack Lee, Paige Yannick. Of course, we also heard from Linda Hujan outside of the Death House. And we are going to be gathering here and doing this quite a few more times during this year. The state of Texas has started to release the names of executions and dates that are coming up. And the next one is going to be on February the 28th. I apologize for giving misinformation a little bit earlier in the broadcast. We will be wrapping up our show for today, and please join us on February the 28th, 2019 at 6 p.m. when the state of Texas plans to execute Billy Cobble. We invite you to visit us on Facebook at Execution Watch or online at executionwatch.org. You can always join our mailing list for all of the latest updates, and please stop by kpft.org to show your support for this program and others when you make your secure contribution to this station. We are beginning to have our next fund drive. Please donate appropriately. Again, our thanks to Larry B. Douglas, Jack Lee, Mike Gillespie, and Paige Yannick, Death House reporter Linda Hujan, executive producer Elizabeth Stein, and our engineer Gordon Anderson for stepping up and for all of their assistance on today's program. Up next is going to be People of Earth with Jacqueline Batiste. Again, if you were listening in for Arab Voices with Saeed, it will be back in its regularly scheduled time period next week. On behalf of the Execution Watch crew, I'm Marlo Blue. Good night.